Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Ben Kay, and welcome to episode 20 of this season's Rugby Tonight podcast. This week, I'm joined by the one and only Brian O'Driscoll, and we're going to look back at a massive weekend for the Celtic sides in the Champions Cup, and a rather sobering one for a few of the Aviva Premiership teams. We'll also cast our eyes over the final round of matches that will confirm the identity of the eight quarter-finalists. Joining us in the studio was Wales and Cardiff legend Martin Williams. We'll hear from him later. So, Brian, first, if we start with some of the ongoing news that's been happening this week, quite a big one for English rugby and maybe quite surprising, Eddie Jones extending his contract past the Rugby World Cup to 2021. But not only that, tying in an almost handover period to whoever's going to take over for him next time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Eddie obviously was the one that was speaking all along that I was just getting to the World Cup. I want to win England the World Cup or help them win one. And never thought or mentioned anything beyond that. Whether he had a vision that he wanted to carry them through for another couple of years or for another term or not, he obviously kept to himself. But he said himself earlier this morning that as soon as those contract negotiations started opening up the deal, it was a fait accompli pretty quickly. He was very interested. I'm interested to understand the minutiae of it, whether if the Lions committee came knocking, whether there's a clause in his contract to entertain that notion or not. But good news for England all round. He's been a revelation since he's come in. He seems to have everyone on tenterhooks, but at the same time getting the very best out of them.
Well, the players really like him. That's the key thing, isn't it? Despite him being quite a hard taskmaster, the players really like him. I think it's quite positive from England. I think, you know, one of the big criticisms since 2003 and having won the World Cup in 2003 was, what do you do next? And it took a long time for that ship to steady and actually go back to planning for the future rather than reacting to what was happening and various results and things. So I think that's quite good. I think Eddie Jones almost wants to create a bit of a legacy for what he's done. And he's done that with some of his selections. If you look at how he's always put youngsters into his squad, knowing that they wouldn't play, but just to get them used to the environment, he's developing the next level of players coming through. And I think he's trying to do the same with that coaching staff. The interesting thing, I guess, will be who is that person that he hands the baton to and takes that year or so to hand over the reins. Will it be someone from within his own camp, or do you think it might be someone from outside?
Not an easy process, you know, because he still has to get the job done. So it's, you know, keeping an eye on the side and on their progress, but at the same time trying to integrate someone new. It obviously would make an awful lot of sense if it was one of the current coaches, be it Borthwick or Gustard, or anyone else that he might bring in over that period of time. But, you know, he seems like a pretty focused individual, and for him to allow a certain amount of time in that year to bring another coach into a system, or, you know, allow them to make that transition, it can't, that's breaking from the norm of what he'd be used to. So it's interesting that he was willing to do that, maybe at the suggestion of at committee level or at board level.
One thing that sort of interests me though is the fact that the guys that he's got coaching, the best number twos in your coaching setup don't necessarily make the best number ones, and it's probably wrong to call it number one and number two, because, you know, a guy in a tracksuit whose major strength is coaching, so let's take the All Blacks, who've led the way for years, Wayne Smith, out and out regarded around the world, any team would want him as their on their coaching staff, leading that environment, but not necessarily doing that almost director of rugby role that we find. So is Steve Borthwick the right man, or do you then lose a lot of his strengths if he can't spend all his time on the training field?
To a very similar point, having spoken to Stuart Lancaster, I think what has really refreshed his enthusiasm for coaching again is the opportunity to actually go and do that, to not be front and centre, not have to deal with, you know, media and off-field components to the role, but actually just get his tracksuit on and go coaching again. And the players have said that he's a revelation at Leinster. So it's interesting. It's not always the case where... be careful what you wish for. Yeah. You know, that top job isn't all that it's made out to be sometimes.
A couple of names in the frame from outside. Obviously, Dean Richards, for a long time, has been linked with various England roles. But Rob Baxter doing amazing things at Exeter. He must be near the top of the list.
And does he need international experience in advance of... of taking over a role like that?
Maybe not if you've got someone like Eddie Jones to help you into it and give you a year and a half of maybe taking a bit of the flak off you and allowing you to grow into that role, particularly if it's coming off the back of a lot of success.
But also, you talk about allowing you to grow into that role. Surely that role is being out front and centre, dealing with that extra pressure that comes with being the focal point of the team. How does a coach gain experience but not without being properly in charge?
Exactly. And it will be very, very interesting. I think even though the RFU announced this now, for the next 4 years or so, we're all going to be talking about how's that going to pan out. And they've almost created another story by releasing the fact that Eddie Jones is going to stay on and help someone through. Right, on to more news from this week. A few disciplinary hearings. It was not the greatest weekend for European rugby in terms of discipline. Probably the easier one to talk about at the beginning is James Haskell's red card for a high tackle. And yeah, I think you'll take that one.
I think they probably got it right. I think around, you know, we were thinking 3 or 4 weeks. Was it reduced from 6 to 4? Am I right?
Yeah.
Which often
happens, doesn't it?
Do you know what it was?
Explain to people at home that what happens usually is you have a tariff which then gets reduced down if there are any mitigating circumstances, or if the player literally just holds his hand up and says, "Yes, I was in the wrong,"
or good behaviour.
Yeah, exactly. If you haven't been prone to doing it throughout your career, so that's why it is a 6-week ban, but it has been reduced down to 4.
And. You know, James Haskell was one of the first ones to hold his hand up. He got his timing wrong.
I think that was all it was.
There was nothing, like, I've heard so much chat about how, you know, it was a malicious hit, you know, intended to go high, and don't be ridiculous.
No, but it's a lesson to all players that the referees and the disciplinary panels are looking for the element of control you have in the game. So if you're out of control, that's when you see a red card.
And that's more likely to happen the more tired you get, the more fatigued you get. So I suppose players need to be more conscious of it the later the game goes.
Right, slightly more contentious and maybe a little bit more difficult to talk about is the Mathieu Bastereau. We obviously don't want to say what he said, but it was in relation to homophobic language that he used. I guess we should probably point out, whatever we say now, we're not condoning what he said.
Absolutely not. But
your take on, has he been dealt with sternly enough? He's had a 6-week ban, knocked down to 3, again, because he held his hand up and said it was wrong.
Guilty, yeah. Well, there was no way he wasn't going to he was going to get away with it. It was picked up clearly on the referee's mic.
Is that a big enough ban, do you think?
Personally, I think no. I think... Does it act as that much of a deterrent that you get a 3-week ban for saying something of a homophobic nature? I'm probably not. I think, you know, you look at the spectrum of different things, be it homophobia, racism, and a multitude of other areas. I suppose they all have to be dealt with.
Yeah.
There's no... comment that is more outlandish than the next when you're dealing with that level of crime, so to speak. So I just feel as though it was an opportunity.
My take on it, and I know I'll get some abuse for this, and I am not condoning what he said. My take on it is this is a golden opportunity, a bit like football had with the Luis Suarez incident, to draw a line in the sand and say, right, this is totally unacceptable. And perhaps they should have punished him more. We've all been in environments where the word that's used has been used by someone. And I don't necessarily think, and you know, Mathieu Bastereau has said that it wasn't directed as a comment to this person to say that they were a homosexual. It was a throw, you know, in his words, a throwaway line. Almost, you know, you'd take it that the guy was a bit soft, which, you know, isn't great because it's tied in with the homophobic language. So I actually don't think he was being homophobic, but he's used homophobic language.
Yeah.
And that is why we have to say, look, this isn't acceptable in our game. It will offend people. Let's cut it out now. Let's never have it again. And I think if someone else used this sort of language, I think the sanction will be higher now. But can they then go back and say, well, hang on, Mathieu Bastereau only got this for
it? Well, we'll look back to Joe Marler, one of the other relevant ones. It was there was a Samson Lee that...
Slightly different in the... Samson Lee was had gypsy heritage, and it was accusing him of being inferior because of his heritage.
That's not my point. My point is, why a £20,000 fine for Joe Marler and nothing for Mathieu Bastereau?
Good point. Yeah.
So I was expecting, as I was reading the disciplinary hearing and waiting to the end of the document to see what the fine would be, and yet there was nothing. So I just don't know what legislates for a fine versus no fine.
I think, as we said at the top, it's a really difficult thing to talk about.
Whenever
anything like this happens, you almost don't want to talk about it because you fear that you're going to offend someone. Whereas at least, you know, people are talking about it and saying, look, this isn't acceptable in our game. Let's get rid of it now. Let's never have it again. And hopefully we can move on and everyone thinks that our sport is inclusive and it is a game for everyone. Okay, let's move off that subject and something slightly more positive, especially if you're a Saracens fan, maybe not so much if you're a London Irish fan. Alex Lewington.
You'd have watched a good bit of him this season. He's been pretty impressive for a team that's at the foot of the table.
Absolutely.
How good a signing do you think he is?
Yeah, only Ollie Woodburn, more clean breaks in the Premiership this season than him. A fantastic talent with ball in hand. I think there are still a few question marks about him defensively, but Saracens is a team that not only will coach him to be better in that regard, but also you know, perhaps some of those defensive frailties can be hidden a little bit more in a team like Saracens. If you're a team that's on the back foot all the time like London Irish, maybe that's a bit more difficult, but certainly ball in hand, probably one of the most exciting talents in the Premiership. A little bit like Christian Wade. When he first broke onto the scene, everyone was saying that, you know, he couldn't defend. Actually, he's got a lot better at defensive now.
I suppose, yes, it's about big squads now and rotation and strength and depth and everything. But if you're Alex Lewington, are you thinking, I'm going to break into that first 15 with Chris Wiles, with the bomb diffuser on the wing in Liam Williams as so-called bomb diffuser.
I think he will. I think he'll think.
Got Maitland on the wing.
Absolutely.
So, but there's plenty of competition.
Yeah, there is. Obviously, we don't know. I don't think we know yet what Nathan Earle's doing as well. But there are rumours that he might be on the move. Chris Wiles is just starting to get to that age profile as a back three player where perhaps, you know, you might think, well, as a younger guy coming through, that there's an opportunity there for me to take his place. I take the point about Sean Maitland, but I think he'll back himself. I think he'll think, if I'm making that many clean breaks a game, as long as I can sort my defensive or perceived defensive weaknesses out, then why won't they pick him?
And then the other big news, maybe Danny Cipriani wasn't delighted to see at Wasps this week, was the signing of Lima Sepawanga from New Zealand. He's obviously realised his days in an All Black jersey might be numbered, and he's moved to the exit to come over to Wasps for next season. A big signing for them.
I think that's
huge. What do you make of that?
Because I don't necessarily think that is a, we're going to sign this guy, so Danny, we don't need you. To me, that looks like the sort of decision that because Danny Cipriani was to look so much better when he's been in the side this year. So to me, that looks a decision by the management, Dai Young, to say, actually, we don't want Danny next year. So we now need to make sure that whoever we bring in is revered around the world as being as good as Danny, because Danny has set the Premiership alight at times this year. So, you know, for whatever reason that is, to me, that looks like we can only let Danny go if we can replace him with this fly half that every club in the world would be clamouring to get their hands on. And they've done it. And as a result, where does that leave Danny Cipriani? Is he going to get back into the England squad if he moves to a Premiership team? Which Premiership team wants him?
Or he's not going to get back into the England team, is he? Realistically, I personally don't see it at this point.
No, and with your knowledge of European rugby, top 14 style, would that suit him, do you think?
Not overly so. Maybe down in Toulon, you know. But beyond there, the top 14 is a grind. Mm. It's not about effective backlines and tens making teams tick, or, you know, expansive with wide, you know, game plan like he's felt or like he's played over the last couple of seasons with Wasp. That's not the way they play the game. They want to kick their goals. The 10 has to be good out of hand, keep his forwards going, and, you know, defensively strong and not give a whole lot away. And I just don't really see top 14 suiting his game. Interesting to see that he's held talks with some French sides, but
I guess the other reason for this, you know, people often put two and two together and make five. And you know, people might say, well, oh, obviously Dai Young and Danny Cipriani don't get on, which is why he doesn't want to keep him. It could be a financial decision. It could be that Danny Cipriani was wanting more money than Dai Young was prepared to play for his fly half, or for Danny, whether he thought that was value or not. And you know, that brings us on to a slightly different point, that Marcus Smith, obviously, is a young 18-year-old. We're hearing rumours that he's been signed up on. He's obviously signed for Harlequins, but it's as much as $230,000. Whether it is that as a whole package or there's bonuses involved or whatever, I think that's one of the hardest things, particularly for the Aviva Premiership teams that don't have that like the Irish provinces do, the national team involvement, is making that salary cap fit when all the players' wages are going up. And actually, although the salary cap has gone up, squads in the Aviva Premiership are falling, because you get the likes of Lima Sapoanga coming into the Premiership, a huge talent, but, you know, maybe someone who's not quite as good a player is thinking, well, if he's on that, I should be on this, and gradually all those wages go up.
And also the wages being offered in France at the moment are also having an effect on the Premiership and on Irish rugby. You know, there's recent signatures of Peter O'Mahony and CJ Stander. You know, they were driving their numbers up.
There is one thing that might change that is the Gift quota, which has come in before now, and it's always been a financial thing. Actually, from next season, I think, or is it this season, that it starts having an effect on points. So if you don't have enough French qualified players in there, or French players that have come through French academies, you actually start to lose points in the season. So I think there might just be a little bit of a softening on, not so much on the top players' wages, and that will have an effect globally, but those middle of the road players that thought, well, I could always go to France, I'm
the
never going to get
capped. Names will still get their money, but it's the tranche just below that where, you know, they're not getting what they think they deserve from their club at home, so they say right, further
afield.
There won't
be that outlet.
Yeah.
And then news from Ireland that Tommy Bow at the end of the season will be hanging up his boots. What a servant
he's been brilliant.
European rugby.
Absolutely brilliant. And he did it in a pretty impressive way too. I didn't know there was a poet in there. I don't know, there might be one line lost on a few people. The reference to George is an RTÉ broadcaster guy called George Hook.
The most positive man.
Yeah, who wasn't Tommy's biggest fan for many, many, many years. But it went, his poem was, I spent most of my career in Belfast. At first, George said I wasn't very fast. Eventually, I found my gears, had some incredible years, but it's time to tell you, this is my last.
There you go. giving up rugby for a career in greetings cards.
But he was, it's no great surprise. I think you can see it. The last couple of seasons he's had some really bad injuries. And that on top of a player where the juice is starting to leave their legs, you know, particularly as an outside back. So the writing was on the wall, but he's been an incredible servant to Ulster. Did a stint in the Ospreys, obviously with Ireland and the Lions. You know, he's had a lot of success with the Lions too, and he was a terrific player. And I said, one for the hard track and one for the trenches. He was a guy that you wanted with you no matter what the conditions were.
Okay, so more news. God, it's a busy week, isn't it? Six Nations squads are starting to be announced. Wales have announced their squad. A couple of new guys into the squad, uncapped duo of James Davis and Josh Adams. There's quite a few injuries in their squad, though. Talupe Faletau is going to miss the first two rounds at least. George North is recovering from a knee injury, but they hope that he might be available. Rhys Priestland sustained a groin injury on Friday. So are Wales going to be able to cope with that? There's some pretty big names missing there, but a couple of exciting guys coming through.
Yeah, there are. I think, you know, Faletau, particularly with the form that he's shown from last summer through to the early part of the season, you know, he's been a world-class operator, but I think he's at the peak of his powers at the moment. He's that age profile where physically he's just dominating players. He's developed this phenomenal engine to him as well, where he's an all-action 80-minute player. So any side in the world would be less off for not having him in their team. George North is an interesting one. George hasn't been at his best for a couple of seasons. Yeah. He's come and gone. He's had, you know, some injury issues himself. Obviously, well-documented concussion problems. And he needs a bit of luck too. He needs a run of games to be able to play his way back into things. He's obviously heading back over the bridge next year, going to, I don't think it's been announced yet which of the regions he's going to.
They're all clamouring for
him. But as much as there's disappointment in losing two, you know, top quality operators like that, I think it's important to also note and to introduce young talent that have proven themselves in the first part of the season. James Davis is probably brother of Jonathan Davis. Has been knocking at that door for a while.
Yeah, it's been a while that people have been surprised he hasn't been included, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm surprised to see that he's uncapped. I thought he might have picked something up on last summer's tour, but he's been very good for the Scarlets. He's very, very good at the ruck. He's a really good link player. He's an Olympics silver medalist with the sevens, so we know his capabilities of playing that elusive open game, and it suited perfectly to Scarlet style and to Wales style to a certain degree, maybe not to the same effect.
Because last year, or maybe for the last 18 months, there's been a shift in the Welsh style, hasn't there? They've opened the game up more. Is that going to suit some of those Scarlets players a little bit more?
Yeah, I think it will. I think I think a lot of it has to do with they've probably changed the personnel in midfield in particular. Obviously, Jonathan Davis isn't going to be fit. There's no Jamie Roberts in this squad. So I know they do want to play a more expansive game, play a game where they can cut teams off first phase or off count or off set piece. Wales never have historically, certainly in my knowledge over the last number of years, have never really done a whole lot in November.
Yeah.
But they're never that far away Six Nations. They're always in the mix. And last year, right down to the final game against France, they could have finished second. They ended up finishing fourth. Yeah. But there was nothing in it. So, interesting. I don't know a whole lot about Josh Adams. You'll have seen a bit more of him, but he knows where the try line is.
He does, and can create something out of nothing if the rest of your attack isn't functioning too well, just with a loose bit of ball that he picks up. So it'll be fascinating whether he can take that form into international rugby. There is a step up, but with his skill set, that I don't think there's any reason why he can't. So hugely exciting pick for me, and very much deserved. Well, that's what Brian and I think of the Wales squad, but someone who probably knows a lot more about the subject is Martin Williams, and these are his thoughts.
I suppose, obviously, the big name is James Davies at Openside. We've got embarrassment of riches in Wales when it comes to the seven position. You know, you guys see Thomas Young week in, week out, carving up the Aviva, but there's no place for him. But James has been superb for the last 3 years, really has been probably the best player in the Pro 14, so he deserves his chance. Big names missing, Jamie Roberts. Feel for Jamie, he's been outstanding for the Quins this year, but hasn't quite got the nod. But, look, there was a lot of concern back home about the amount of injuries we had going into the Six Nations, but without Sam Warburton and Jonathan Davis, that's probably a fully fit squad, so it's a really strong-looking squad.
Is that change that you were talking about, some of the players that are not involved, is that a reflection of a change in tactics by the Welsh management, or has the players reflected the change in tactics to that slightly more open?
No, I think the Welsh management have taken on board that, you know, they picked Owen Williams at 12 in the autumn, and they are trying. I think they've learned from the Lions, particularly most of the Welsh management were on that trip. And if they are going to improve, if we are going to start winning championships again, they realise they've got to expand their game. England have done that. So I think it's just the fact that they... And we've got players who can play that way as well, you know. So, you know, Owen Williams, Liam Williams is back as well, who's huge for us as a back line. So it's just, I think it is a change in philosophy, the way Wales are going to play.
So France have announced their squad, the first one since Guinovez's departure and Jack Brunel's. Brought back in someone from the cold in Morgan Parra that Guinovez didn't have a whole lot of time for. He's been in a little bit of a stuttering Clermont team, but there's no doubt he's got a wealth of experience internationally, both at 9 and 10.
Well, what's interesting on that, perhaps, is his ability to hopefully get the best out of the people around him. If you look at some of the selections, there's some interesting youngsters coming through. The guy I'm most excited about seeing whether he can make that step up is Mathieu Jalibert, who plays for Bordeaux. I saw him for half a game of rugby in against Newcastle up at Kingston Park, and genuinely the most impressive 40 minutes I've seen by an up-and-coming player. The person I've been most excited by just had everything. You know, Newcastle went after him, flew out of the line, tried to get him his passing game, his running game. He scored a worldy try. And, yeah, he is, to me, could well be a global superstar. And for him to be thrown in at this age in a French team. And you know, over the last few years, France have been very pragmatic, haven't they, really? Mm. That they haven't had a settled 9-10 combination, but they tend to be quite pragmatic. You know, this guy could easily now hold down the 10 shirt for many years to come.
And Jacques Brunel, you know, probably didn't have the squad with Italy that he wanted to play the style that maybe he'd had some success down in Perpignan with.
Yeah, I think the other thing that's really interesting to me is the fact that they've put together that coaching panel. Jacques Brunel is obviously an old, well-established coach, but maybe a little bit like Eddie Jones. They've put him in to oversee everything, but they've got a load of quite young, exciting, talented up-and-coming coaches working as a panel underneath him. And yeah, they didn't have that with Guinovez, I don't think. I don't think that was a strong enough element. And, we'll see now whether there's been a total shift in mindset from the French that actually... We're not going to live week to week. We're going to plan for the future. And some of these admissions into the squad, Danny Priso coming in as well. Maybe they're looking to the future a little bit more.
Yeah, no Tron Duke, no Louis Picamole.
Well, Picamole's the big one, but he has been not his usual self, having gone back to Montpellier from Northampton. He was such an important player for Northampton last year, and perhaps some of their struggles this year has been the fact that
they've such a never reliance replaced on
him,
them, yeah.
And he gave them that go forward. So maybe that's just the slight kick up the rear that he needs to start performing. I can understand Tran Duc. I think
he's on the bench for too long.
Yeah, exactly.
More often than not.
Yeah, exactly. I think maybe we might have seen the end of his international career, unless there are injuries or an opportunity that he has to come back in to fill for. But certainly that it looks, particularly at 10, like they're looking for the future.
And then with the Ireland squad has literally just hot off the press the last 10 or 15 minutes, no huge surprise. I suppose the one name that the whole country of Ireland were hoping to have included on the list is Jordan Larmour.
Good decision?
I think it's a good decision, whether he's used or not.
Yeah.
I think introduction into the squad. You know, your first time being named in any Irish squad is a big moment in your life. He's just turned 20. He's had a run of really impressive games for Leinster.
You know Joe Schmidt.
Yeah.
How will he integrate him into the squad? Will he just throw him in at the deep end? Will it be very, very softly approach? Or?
I'd imagine softly. Listen, Joe mixes things up, so right. You know, keeps us guessing. The big thing is, does he see him in his squad for 2019, or is he lining him up for the future thereafter? Yeah. There's a long time still to go to September next year. And lots of opportunities. Whether he gets it this Six Nations or not, I'm not entirely sure. I think bringing him into the squad, I suppose letting him understand what's expected of him, you know, that integration process with seasoned internationals. There's a big gulf in class between Pro 14 rugby, which he's largely been playing, yeah, and international rugby. The systems will be slightly different, so I'd be surprised if I saw him throwing him in early on.
Everyone's screaming about what Jordan Larmont can do. Where are the areas that, if he is going to be in that Rugby World Cup squad, he needs to improve? Where would his weaknesses be at the moment?
Well, I think his understanding positionally. I think he's a good tackler, yeah, but not necessarily a brilliant defender.
Right,
and
yeah.
I think, you know, he played a lot of his schoolboy rugby at 13. Now he's being asked to play at fullback.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have a huge amount of experience. He's got some great coaches, you know, in Gervin Dempsey at Leinster. He's got Rob Kearney and Issa Nasiwa to show him the ropes behind the scenes at training as well. So he's in good hands. It's just a matter of what is his best position. It is easier to find yourself to be integrated into a setup on the wing than it is at fullback.
Yeah.
I think there's,
yeah,
more onus and more responsibility on you as a fullback, whereas as a winger, it's, yes, you're part of that pivot, of that pendulum, but the focus isn't on,
yeah,
your attacking game, on your last line of defence, on your kicking game as much as it,
yeah,
is,
sure,
in the 15 jersey. So that is an opportunity for Joe to bring him into the side, maybe play him on the wing. But I think they do need to try and choose a position. I'm almost contradicting myself because I don't like players being pigeonholed into one position. We should,
yeah,
have that French capability. I love Damien Trai. He used to play 10,
Australia
12, 15
as well. Yeah.
On the wing sometimes.
Yeah.
I love that. So I don't want to. But for a player so young, if he is going to be part of this Irish World Cup squad,
yeah,
he needs to find a
Nailed
position.
Down.
Yeah, and it's not going to be 13, realistically. There's lots of centres.
Yeah.
So it's going to be on the wing or at 15. And he can learn both, but find a position,
yeah,
for 6 months or a year and let him play there. And is Joe Schmidt thinking that he's the capabilities of being Ireland's fullback for the World Cup? He is so exciting in attack. There are so many, particularly seasoned players that are getting, you know, to the winter of their career,
yeah, sure,
that are scared out of their lives playing, yeah, against this guy. He can just make you look silly for fun. But the question marks is his kicking game, which it can come on. I think he sees space very well, so his chipping game and his little grubber game is very good. I think his longer kicking game needs work. But his defensive positioning, of understanding when he's last man, when he has to attack the winger, you know, he's been exposed a couple of times from backing off, and I just hope he's getting the right messages to him of where he can improve, because by all accounts, he picks up things very quickly. He's not just this athlete, this raw athlete. I think he gets it, and that's why lots of the Leinster squad are very excited about him being part of it.
Okay, well, as we've mentioned, you know, all three of those teams have got exciting new talent coming through. Josh Adams, Jalibert for France, and then we've just been talking about Jordan Larmont. Scotland have a young man by the name of Greg Laidlaw coming through. He's back in the squad, first time involvement with Test rugby since February 2017, when he tore his ankle ligaments against France. Broken leg versus Claremont in October. What's Gregor Townsend going to do? Is he going to stick with Ali Price? Is he just coming back in to the fold because he deserves to be there because of his history? What?
For me, I think he sticks with Ali Price at the moment. I think he's the player in form. Obviously, Laidlaw's been out for huge parts of the season. But I think the combination with Finn Russell at Glasgow, even though they probably haven't achieved at European level like they would have wanted, they've been good at Pro 14. And Ali Price had a very effective November series. So it's the man in possession of the jersey, and I think he's the one that has to be replaced.
Is there an element, because Scotland have had all sorts of problems injury-wise up front. They've got five front rows missing. 36-year-old Scott Lawson comes back into the squad for the first time in 4 years. Is a little bit of that selection decision around nine, whether the forward pack's on the front foot or whether they can't mix it up?
Yeah, but knowing Gregor Townsend, he's not someone that cuts his cloth an awful lot. Yeah, he's a smart coach, but at the same time, he wants to play the game in an expansive, fast, free-flowing way. And I think Ali Price undoubtedly lends himself to being in that nine jersey a lot more than Greg Laidlaw. With respect to Laidlaw, he's been very, very good for Scotland over the last number of years, you know, controls things brilliantly. But I think there's been an evolution within that Scottish team. It was started by Vern Cotter and I think picked up by Gregor Townsend. A couple of last season, a summer win against Australia, a November win against Australia. So the only way you're going to beat, you're not going to grind those teams down and beat them, you know, regularly by playing 10-man rugby.
No, exactly.
You're going to have to score tries. And I think that's been the Glasgow way, and I think that's going to become the Scotland way.
Yeah. Right, England, it's not confirmed till Thursday, but we're hearing a few little things. Obviously, there's a big injury issue, particularly, Joe Marler's ban and the Ellis Genge out, so loose head's an area, but the area that's probably causing him most problems at the moment is at number eight, with Billy Vunipola's injury breaking his wrist against the Ospreys. We know that Nathan Hughes is out injured. Haskell's now got a ban, so he couldn't be the guy to come in. Sam Simmons, do you think he's the next off the rank?
Well, you know, you never know how you'll get your opportunity. You know, yeah. And sometimes you do need two and three injuries in front of you where you're way down the pecking order and all of a sudden you're catapulted into the setup. And if you can play well, I talked before about the player in possession, then it's very hard to replace you. Now, I know when Billy Vunipola comes back into any England team, he's more often than not a game or two with Saracens, and he's so good that he's going to get back into that jersey. I think he's that much better than everyone else out there. But great opportunity for Sam Simmons. He's been very good for the Chiefs, particularly in the Premiership. His stats are quite impressive, and there's just question marks as to how England want to play the game. He's not physically the biggest guy in the world, so do they have to adapt their game slightly to bring the best out in him, or does he have to evolve into the English pattern?
Yeah, I mean, he's not, as you said, size-wise, he's a big carrier. He's an explosive carrier, isn't he? He's plenty of pace. I think Eddie Jones' concern was, is he big enough to play eight? I think maybe saw him more as a seven, perhaps. But I think he can do a role there, and particularly if Eddie Jones is going to pick a big number six, a Courtney Laws at number six, or a Maro Itoje at number six, and play with almost a five and a half in that position.
So does that mean that Chris Robshaw finds himself out of the 20, onto the bench, or does he move him across to seven?
Who knows? Because that is, I mean, I guess it depends on the fitness of everyone else around there. Tom Curry.
Who would you like to see at six? If you're naming your England back row.
If I was naming my England back row, I would 100% first name on the whole team sheet, I think, would be Courtney Laws at six, because I know that I've got enough. Well, this sounds ridiculous. I know that the second row is a particularly strong area, and I think Courtney, how he's developed over the last 2 years, and answered those criticisms, oh, he's not a big enough ball carrier. He's now Northampton's primary ball carrier and does it exceptionally well. He's got a big work rate, defensively superb. So I'd have no qualms at sticking him in. And also, we know how important first phase line-out ball is, and he gives you that proper line-out option as a third guy along with other people. Who you partner him in with in the second row, I think Maro Itoje's, although he's not quite in the form he was last year, he's still the first name in that second row pairing. And then it's whether you've got someone like a George Cruz, who's been out of the training squad, so we'll see whether he's announced in the squad on Thursday, or Nick Ezekwe, another Saracens. Saracens are just blessed with so many second rows. Or has Launchbury done enough He's got an embarrassment of riches in that position. Where he doesn't have an embarrassment of riches, particularly with the injury problems over the last few months, is at seven and eight. And that combination, how you fit that in around Courtney Laws maybe, or you know, another big six, it will be his biggest problem, I think. Well, Italy are going to keep us waiting until next week for their squad, but be interesting to see Conor O'Shea, where he goes with that. Jake Pelledri, who's been on fire for Gloucester, is obviously been rumoured to be training with the squad, so that'll be of real interest to particularly Gloucester fans. Right, if we move on to the Champions Cup and what happened last weekend briefly in review. Pretty poor week for the Aviva Premiership again. It's not been a good tournament for them.
No, it hasn't. In the corresponding fixture with the Scarlets, Bath had a big win in Parc of Scarlet, maybe against the odds, and that set them up brilliantly. In the pool, particularly with having Benetton as you know, one of their sides, but they got absolutely dismantled by Scarlets in the wreck.
Was that just everything clicking for Scarlets, or was the gulf between the two teams? Well, the reason I say that is because sometimes you can play in games and actually, you know, everything comes off for you, and the psychology that has, that when you're just running in tries for fun, it dents the opposition. Do you think that was a case, or do you think that Bath were totally outclassed then? It would have been totally outclassed anyway.
I think it's a small bit of both. I would, in Scarlets' defence, In that corresponding fixture,
yeah,
it was biblical rain.
It was terrible.
It was horrible.
They still tried to play.
And they still play. And they still scored. Steph Evans scored this unbelievable try, which I think we voted for, the public voted as try of the round. So to still play and attempt to go after them, maybe they were a bit naive in trying to overplay.
Yeah.
But that they needn't worry in the wreck at the weekend on Friday. The conditions were perfect, dry ball, and they were excited about it. And they knew what they had to do. Yeah. They weren't happy with winning the game. They knew they were going to have to go out and get 5 points. And they duly did it, scoring some scorchers. Just brilliant decision making. Rhys Patchell moved from 10 to 15, came in as a second receiver, one on the left, one on the right, that little left foot grubber for Scott Williams. I think that was the bonus point try. They were so easy to watch, and they've set themselves up, given themselves a brilliant opportunity.
Genuine
against
contenders.
Back as contenders, when you lose the first two, everyone forgets about you, and they've kind of slipped in under the radar to get themselves to 17 points, as far as I know, 16 or 17 points. So a win would they top the group.
At their place against Toulon, do you fancy them?
Yeah, I do. I think it's. Yeah. I don't think you'll see a repeat of that Bath performance. They're hardly ever beaten in Parc of Scarlet, and I think potentially two can come from that group. Toulon are sitting pretty on 18 points. If they can get a losing bonus point, I definitely think 19 will be enough.
Well, it should be, if it goes Scarlet's way, it should, you'd think, be an open game, which also could lead to a four tries for the losing side.
Yeah, and obviously at that point the focus would be trying to get themselves a home. Yeah. A home quarter final, because no one will enjoy the thought of going there.
Okay, well, the other big performance for me was Exeter. I think they'll be disappointed with how the tournament's gone so far, particularly the head-to-head against Leinster and losing at Sandy Park. They certainly bounced back at home to Montpellier, who would have been a lot of people's on a lot of people's favourites list going into this game.
Yeah, they were. Myself and Lawrence were down in Sandy Park on Saturday, and they were outstanding. It was a very disciplined performance. They played against the breeze in the first half. They just grinded it out, and against all good sides, no one capitulates after 30 or 40 minutes. You've got to play them at 50, 60, 70 minutes. Sometimes it takes right into the 78th or 79th minute, but they just started picking them off. So they went in a try up. I think it might have been 10-3 or 10-0 at halftime, and then they just built on that score. They kicked their goals, to keep Montpellier at bay.
Yeah.
It's important to keep that scoreboard ticking over, putting that pressure into points, and then they were patient with those opportunities. And Ollie Woodburn's finishing was outstanding. a guy can't do any more to put his hand up for an international call than
thing,
he has.
The other thing that's amazing, you know, you look at some of the comments by Bath fans who obviously had him, and they're saying, well, why couldn't we get that sort of performance out of him? And it is amazing how some places suit some players better than others, isn't it? They obviously have to go up to the Scotstoun this weekend. It's a bit difficult for them, isn't it? They're the early kickoff on a Saturday, so they're the first game, and they don't know how many points they're going to require to qualify. Is it going to be 19? Is it going to be 18? They're on 14 at the moment. So do they have to go all out for the bonus point?
They'll be thinking win and we're in great shape.
Yeah.
Just trying to get a sense of what their points difference is, 28. Versus the other teams that potentially could get to 18, Saracens and Bath are plus 11.
Yeah, exactly.
So they are in a good spot. Yeah. So you would imagine if they could go and win the game, it might be enough. They'll guarantee qualification if they can get a bonus point. But not many sides of, you know, yes, in Europe, Glasgow have been poor, but they're unbeaten in the Pro 14.
Yeah.
What team are they going to put out?
Yeah.
And how much... ambition do they to finish the competition on a high? I don't know. I think Exeter will have enough. It's just the question as to whether they can get those 5 points and be the first team to book themselves through as best runners-up.
Well, I'll have a front row seat for that one. You can too. It's on at 12:30 on BT Sport 3.
One of the other big games from the weekend that you were in Wales, where the Ospreys hosted two-time champion Saracens, and they potentially went a long way towards knocking the holders out.
Huge performance from the Ospreys. I think Saracens, you know, perhaps were dented a little bit psychologically by the loss of Jackson Ray before the game with a hamstring. Then they lost Michael Rhodes and Billy Vunipola at half-time with injuries. Having said that, they finished with a pretty good back row. Maro Toji slotting into the sixth role and Berger as well. So, you know, they weren't weakened, but I think psychologically it might have knocked them out. But the Ospreys played it really, really well, and it wasn't the greatest game of rugby by any means. It was a pretty dire affair, but really well played from the likes of Dan Bigger pulling the strings, Reece Webb as well. So look, Ospreys fully deserved it, and now they've given themselves a shot, and you didn't think they were going to get that shot, but that draw means that they could go to Claremont, which sounds a ridiculously tough encounter. Claremont, this is our game on BT Sport 2 at 3 p.m. on Saturday. Claremont against Ospreys. You wouldn't give them any hope because of Claremont's track record in Europe, but Claremont have been rubbish the last few weeks.
They have, and they've got a horrible injury list. I think they've got 11 outside backs they couldn't choose from last weekend, on top of three or four forwards. So if ever you're going to Stade Marcel Michelin, now is a good time to do it. Yeah. And having lost the first couple of games in Europe, they were still pretty effective, Ospreys. A good loss, if ever there's a good loss to Saracens down in Allianz Park, where they picked up a couple of points. A great second half performance to Claremont in the opening game of the competition. So to know they could go down there and turn them over and top the pool is quite a shout, considering where they were playing, looking down at round three.
Are Saracens completely out of it?
They're not. The Saracens must go to must play in Allianz Park and win five, gain all 5 points against Northampton, a resurgent Northampton, who themselves had a really good victory against Claremont last weekend. They'll enjoy the prospect as well of helping everyone else keep the holders out of the tournament if they can deny them that bonus point, or in fact go and rattle some cages and have a big result. That would be a turn up for the books. But I just sense, good teams don't go away quietly, and Saris will definitely feel as though, they've had big wins against Northampton thus far this year, early on in Twickenham and then in Franklin's Gardens. Can they go back and get 5 points, get that points difference up nice and high, and set a target for others to try and pick off?
I think that's exactly the messages Saracens would have had all week. It'd be ignore Europe. Let's just say we're out of Europe, and if something better happens, then something better. We cannot allow an Aviva Premiership rival to get a psychological advantage on us and think that they're back at the races. We need to go down and show everyone that we're a boss. Well, both those games are live on BT Sport 2. As I said, Claremont Ospreys, BT Sport 2 at 3 p.m. on Saturday. And at the same time, if you flick over to BT Sport 3, you'll see Saracens against Northampton Saints. OK, so Sunday's fixtures, Leicester Racing, Munster Castra, La Rochelle and Harlequins, but probably the standout one is Wasps Ulster, because both teams really, you know, although not favourites, both teams can still do something this tournament.
They can. Obviously, it's very much in Ulster's favour. They're topping the pool. They know if they can gain a victory against Wasps, they'll definitely, at worst, be best placed second up, runner-up in a group, depending on what happens with La Rochelle. And Quinns, you'd imagine with La Rochelle's home record that they'll get all 5 points, and then they've got a better head-to-head record against Ulster. You know, is it probably too much of an ask for Ulster to go to Coventry and get a bonus point try? Maybe they'll just be thinking victory and we'll be in the knockout stages. The thing about Wasps, and they must be kicking themselves this week. Like, they had this phenomenal opportunity to be at home in the final game, and probably they were, if they got 2 points at 13, they wouldn't have topped the group. But to back themselves against an Ulster side that haven't been in brilliant form this whole year, to go and beat them in the final game, they would have bitten your hand off for that. And the total capitulation that was the performance against Quinns last week now leaves them in a spot where they need so many things to go their way. It's not inconceivable to see that they have something to play for. They do have the luxury, before they take the field, to know exactly what they might need to do, or that they're out of the competition. One way or another, they're going to be knowing what cards they're playing. So in the situation where there's a loss of Exeter up in Glasgow, and then Racing losing to Leicester, it gives them an outside shot. So you would be very surprised to see 17 points qualified.
Yeah.
Because of the position of the groups at the moment, but those crazy results do go.
Extra qualifying a few years ago because Claremont made the wrong decision.
Exactly,
at the wrong time,
it's happened go with rather than picking up a losing bonus point. So it is fortuitous that they have the final fixture. No one loves playing at 3 o'clock on a Sunday, but it's the one weekend that you wouldn't be afraid of doing so, because they will know, and obviously Ulster will know what they need to do regarding the other pools, but they won't know what's going on in that corresponding fixture with La Rochelle and Quinns.
Well, no one might like playing at 3 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon, but lots of people like watching it on TV, and you can do exactly that. BT Sport 2 and 4K UHD for the Wasps-Ulster match, 3 p.m. on Sunday. Thanks for listening to the Rugby Tonight podcast. We'll be back next week with Austin Healy and David Flatman dissecting the weekend's European action. Remember to subscribe to the pod to make sure it gets delivered to your device every Thursday morning. And if you've enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a lovely review. Bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.